Bodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantadhami Bhagavad-gītē bhavad-dveshini.
Sixteen?
I think I did 16, didn't I? You know, Michael?
I know it's somewhere.
Well, I'm going to review 16. I know I did it, but I'm going to review it because it moves well into the next verse. So it's chapter 18, verse 16. Tatraivam satikartaram Tatraivam satikartaram Atmanam kevalam tuyaha Atmanam kevalam tuyaha Pashatya krita buddhitvat Pashatya krita buddhitvat Sorry, buddhitvat Nasa pashyati durmatihi, nasa pashyati durmatihi. Tatra evam sati kartaram atmanam kevalam tuyaha. Pashyati akrita buddhitvat, na saha pashyati durmatihi. This whole section, really, maybe starting from verse 13, several verses that are, the whole point of the verse, of these section of verses, is to differentiate, be able to differentiate the Atma and the Self as the Adhishtana, and everything else as that which is objectified and is mithya. Adhishtana means that which is the very truth of whatever is mithya. Mithya is that which totally depends upon the self for its being. And so, what Krishna is saying here is he says to Arjuna in verse 13 that he says, please understand me here. I'm just making a literal translation. Please understand me here. There are five causes, five things that are responsible for the completion of all karmas, for the accomplishment of all karmas. And these five things, which are delineated in the Sankhya, means in the Vedanta. Even in the Sankhya Yoga, there's a tremendous... What Sankhya Yoga, or the Sankhya, is does very thoroughly is to delineate the three gunas, the sattva, rajas, and tamas, and all of the different parts of the prakriti, of the creation, and all of the different, everything that's derived from maya, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are delineated in the Sankhya. So Sankhya also means that which is delineated, all numbered, organized. So in the Vedanta also, these things are organized, delineated. Like, for instance, Sankhya would be that there are 19 component parts to the subtle body, right? That's delineated in the Vedanta. It's also very well delineated in the Sankhya Yoga. That the sukshma, that the jiva has three shariras, the karana sharira, the causal body, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, and the physical sharira. And that they have five koshas. So all of these things are very clearly delineated in order to differentiate them from the Atma, from the Self. That's why, I mean, it's interesting, and it has its purpose, but its primary purpose is to give you, to objectify all of the components of the physical body and the subtle body and the causal body in such a way to differentiate it with a subject-object relationship from consciousness itself. So you're delineated, you're given all of these things to become aware of so that you can start with a subject-object relationship between the ultimate subject, consciousness, which cannot be objectified, and all of the parts of you that you have taken to, literally taken to be yourself. You know, there's a whole conglomerate of things that you had actually taken to be yourself. These are enumerated. That's what we mean by Sankhya. All of these mistaken points of identification are enumerated in different ways. The five koshas, the anamaya kosha, the pranamaya kosha, the manomaya kosha, the vijnanamaya kosha, the anandamaya kosha, the three shariras, the sukshma sharira, the stula, sukshma, and kadana shariras, the three bodies, so the three bodies, the five sheaths, the 18 component, 19 components of the sukshma sharira, all of these are sankhya. They're all enumerated so that you can, with each one of them, come into a subject-object relationship and thereby break your identification with them. The idea being that if I am aware of something, I have a subject-object relationship with it, I watch it change, I watch the experience come into being and going out of being, that experience allows me to differentiate myself from it. Myself as the subject who is aware of this as the object. And then it goes on from there in the whole teaching methodology. Whatever I can objectify, you know, as an object, I can turn my back on. In other words, the whole world of your experiences that we delineate, even in terms of the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, that's Sankhya. That's an enumeration, right? So the elements and the elementals, these are things that I'm aware of. Anything that I delineate, you know, and enumerate for you, you can become aware of that, right? And any and everything that you can be aware of in terms of a subject-object relationship, you can dismiss. You can be without. This is key. If I can be, and it goes this far, if I can be without the experience of something, I'm not that. Because I still am, and that particular experience is not there. That means the very experience itself is not fundamental to my being. Because I can be without that experience. We don't have to talk about physical objects. We can just, it's enough just to talk about experience. If I can negate the experience and be without it, it's not fundamental to me. But in order to make a thorough negation, we need to enumerate all of the experiences because you might not think of all of them. Right? So the Vedanta is very thorough, and Sankhya also very, very thorough in making these enumerations. So here, in this verse 13, it says, you know, Sankhya Kritante, as it is told in the Sankhya, which enumerated in these in this enumeration, which comes Krita Anta, which comes after what has to be done. That's why we say Vedanta. Krita means that which is to be done, or that which is done. Krita Anta, it comes at the end of that. The first, in the whole Vedas, the first portion of the Veda, right, is what we call the Karmakanda. The Karmakanda is made up of Dharma and rituals, the things which I do, the things which need to be done. The Vedanta comes after that. The Vedanta is not concerned anymore with what has to be done or what it is to be done, right? The first part of the Vedas is all about doing and what are your duties. But in the end, the first part of the Vedas, the Karmakanda, the people will live their life under the auspices of that Vedic culture, you know, and gain from that what we call Antakarana Shuddhi. The Vedas lays out a map for Antakarana Shuddhi, especially for the Mumukshu, a person whose life is contained within Dharma. That's the first portion of the Vedas. And understanding gives values and understanding for containing your life within Dharma, which gives antakarana shuddhi, which gives rise to an inner reflection, which gives rise to a need for the Vedanta. Right? The Vedanta comes at the end. The Vedanta is called the Jnanakanda, the person who then needs to know, well, what is this really all about? Who am I? The who am I question. You know, what is the purpose of all of this? Where is there fullness? Is there anything, you know, that is there anything about me that survives death? Is there anything about me that's free from dharma, adharma? The whole first part of the Vedas is dharma, adharma. But then dharma, adharma, you're on kind of a roller coaster ride on a treadmill. You're always having to maintain, always having to figure out and to try to be a good person. Is there any way to get off of that? That's the Vedanta. What is the truth of the whole thing? So in this Sankhya, all of these things, these five things are told as being those things which are necessary, which are causal, which allow for, are responsible for, the accomplishment of sattva karma, for all karmas. And so he lists them. In the next verse, in 14, he lists them. First one, adhishtanam. Adhishtanam here means the adhishtana for all of the others, the basis, which is the physical body in this situation. The adhishtana, the karta, which means the karta, the doer, which means the vijnanamaya kosha, the buddhi, with the ahankara. The third one is the karana, that means the manomaya kosha, the manas, the mind, and the sense organs, and the organs of action. So that's one, two, three. And then all of the pranas that give life force to the body. And then daivam means all of the laws, Ishwara, the whole order of the creation that allows for all of these things to operate. So it's these five things that are responsible for any and every action that is done. Without these things, without your body, without your living body that's enlivened by prana, without your buddhi, the one that makes choice and decision, the ahankara, without the organs of action and without the sense organs, you can't really do anything. These are the things that do karma. Without that, you can't do karma. Okay? So these become causal to karma. And then he goes on to say, now, and it is these five things that are responsible for a person's, a person engages, whatever karma a person engages in, whether by the physical body, or by vak, by your speech, or by your mind, these are the three instruments, ways you can do karma. You can do physical karma, you can do karma through speech. You know, that's an action. A speech is an action. You know, it's a choice. You can hurt people through your speech, you can bless people through your speech. Speech is a karma. You know, it wields an effect. Physical activity wields an effect. Mind. We did this last week, but anyway, that mind, what you think, also can be a karma. If it's just the thought flow, the manas traveling through, it's not a karma. It's just scenery. Karma means when the buddhi says a prayer, for instance, a prayer. That's a karma. According to the Shastra, it's a karma. You do a prayer, it has a subtle result. You do a curse, that's a karma. That's a papa karma. Because by curse, that's a negative prayer. You're directing, you're willing that somebody be harmed in some way. Right? That's considered a karma. It's a papa karma. A prayer is a punya karma. You're wanting to help. You know, you're giving your best wishes to somebody, or you're doing a tapas for their well-being. You know, that's a karma, because it's considered to have an effect. You can even do, like the rakshasas or the asuras, who are so powerful, can be so powerful, they can do all kinds of tapas and rituals for negative end. That can be done, that type of tapas, that type of discipline, you know, even and mental discipline can be done in order to gain negative results. So So here, what Krishna is saying, he says, those karmas which are initiated either through your body, mind, or speech, whether they be dharmic, nyayam, following the order, Ishwar's order, or viparitam, viparitam va, or going against Ishwar's order, papa karmas, all of them, all of the punya type of karmas that you're doing, or the papa karmas, all of them depend upon these five factors. If you get rid of the body and the mind and the sense organs and the organs of action and the prana, say it's a dead body, you know, this the vak and the mind and the sharir and the body are not available. You can't do any karma without these things. So now, that being the case, that these are the instruments that are necessary and the causal for doing any type of action, he goes on to say in this verse 16, tatra evam sati. When this is the case, you know, then the person who takes atmanam kevalam, the atma, which is, now kevalam can be often used as an adverb, where it would mean only or merely or solely. Kevalam can mean that. Kevalam also means which is one without a second. Mm, mm. So sometimes when we say kevalam in terms of Brahman, or the kevalam atma, we mean that atma which is absolutely pure. When you say pure, what that means is there is no second thing there to tarnish it. Again, we could say the atma from the standpoint of the mind is, you know, from the mind is tarnished by avidya, by ignorance. Right? Atma is not ever tarnished by anything. Because from the standpoint of atma, from the self, there is only one non-dual self. It has no parts at all. There is nothing that can change its nature in any way. So one way that we often translate kevalam is one without a second. It means within itself it has no parts, right? And it has no second thing. Right? Within itself it has no parts, nor does it have a second thing. So it's one without a second. So here he says, the one who takes this kevalam atma, the atma which is absolutely pure, one without a second, to be the doer, kartadam, to be a doer, he says, that one who sees the atma, pushyati, sees the atma as that, why does he see the atma as that? He says, akrita buddhitvat, because of having a mind, a buddhi, it means the mind, the buddhi is the one who gains knowledge, which is akrita. Akrita means it hasn't been made yet. in this sense. it hasn't been knowledge yet. That buddhi is akrita. It hasn't gained knowledge. It hasn't matured yet. So the akrita buddhi is the buddhi that hasn't yet, up to this point, gained that atmajnanam, gained self-knowledge. Hasn't been exposed to the pramana. Hasn't been exposed to the Vedanta pramana. Vedanta pramana means within the context of India, within the context of the Vedas. The first part of the Vedas is not interested in who you are. In reality, it's interested in the jiva, and in the jiva having a relatively happy existence within samsara. That's the first part of the Vedas. That's it. This is how you follow dharma. These are the duties that are enjoined on you. These are the rituals that you're supposed to do. This is the way you're supposed to behave. And that will give you relative shanti, relative antakarana shuddhi, within this dual creation. But that first part of the Vedas has not been finished yet. We're not over to the other side yet. The other side takes place for the mumukshu, who now says, you know, what is the truth of all of this? Who am I? Who is Ishwara really? What is the point of it all? The one who recognizes kind of the mityatva or the nityatva, the anityatva, the continual changing nature of the creation. Where is there fulfillment here? A fulfillment that's not lasting is not really a fulfillment. That's what fulfillment or happiness that's not lasting is what we call a dukkha yoni. It's a womb for dukkha, because the happiness or the ananda or the fulfillment comes to an end. So that can't be the end game here, because what every human being, every animal, every living being seeks is an ananda, not a temporary ananda. The temporary ananda is viewed like a man drowning in the ocean. A man drowning in the ocean who's being pulled under by the tidal, by the currents, the same currents that pull him under, push him up for some air. So when he's up for air, he has a moment of ananda, you know, only to be pulled down again. So after that's happened enough and you start realizing what's really going on and that you're not going to be allowed to stay up, the same currents that push you up will pull you down. It's not that they're going to change their mind and push you up and keep you up there. Mm. Once you realize that, you know, that then you have to come up with some other kind of solution. Because your ananda, the finite nature of your ananda or your little experiences of fullness become just wounds for dukkha, because you know what's around the corner. And in fact, for all of us, before we gain knowledge, every moment of ananda that you have has an underpinning of dukkha, because you're smart. The psyche is very smart. It has figured it out from lifetimes of experience, not knowing what to do with it, keeping it in the unconscious. But there's always the sorrow underneath, because you know that this beautiful moment will come to an end. But sometime you say, this is not right. What is the truth of all of this? And that time, then you become ready for the Upanishads. And at that time, the way the universe works is an intelligent creation. You meet somebody who can teach you. That's all Ishwara. In fact, to really understand the depth of that, whatever form the teacher comes in, if you are a mumukshu, this is just tradition, but something that I think all of us have experienced also. If you're a mumukshu, then you will meet a teacher who can teach you. That's number one. Because you're a mumukshu, that's why. You know, it has nothing to do with the teacher. It has to do with you being a mumukshu. You will meet a teacher who can teach you. And not only that, you will hear what you need to hear. And that's why we're always, all of that, almost everybody I know has always said, when listening to Vedanta, and I had this experience for so many years with Swamiji, as I needed it, it would be there. That has nothing to do with the teacher. That has to do with the promise of the Upanishads, really, with the tradition, with the very nature of the creation itself. If you are a mumukshu, once you become a mumukshu, this knowledge has to fructify. And you get what you need, and that will come out of the teaching as it needs to come out. You know, Bhagavan's a genius. It just comes out in the way that it's supposed to come out. It's a very beautiful thing. So the kritta buddhi is the one who has gained this knowledge. So because of being a kritta buddhi, one who has not yet gained that knowledge, then that person will see this atma, which is one without a second, as being a doer, right? Even though this being so, things that are actually responsible for our actions really only have to do with the body, the mind, the buddhi, the ahankara, the prana, the karmendriyas, and the jnanendriyas. That's what is responsible for any action. But because of that ajnanam, that person is what we call, he says, saha nasaha pashyati. That person can't see. He can't see because he's a durmati. That person is a durmati. A durmati means his mind has gone off in the wrong direction. His mind is not right. He's not thinking right. And it's not. It's not thinking right because The subject has been superimposed on the object, and the object has been superimposed on the subject. So you're lost in that ajnanam. So you're a durmati. Your mind's gone off. It's not that it's gone off. It's never been on.
It's never thought right.
It's never right until the problem is solved. And the problem is solved. Otherwise, you'd have to say, at one time I was a jnani. I don't know how many lifetimes ago I was a jnani, but somehow I got off the track, and now I'm an ajnani. That's not how it works. You don't go from knowledge to ignorance. You go from ignorance to knowledge. There's a lot of study that's been, a lot of teaching around this. One example they use for, in terms of really understanding this, you have to understand the beginningless of ignorance. Just think, what is the prior condition of ignorance? Ignorance is it. Are you going to say knowledge? Is knowledge the prior condition of ignorance? I say, no, knowledge is not the prior condition of ignorance. Like say somebody, for instance, this is an example, somebody walks in the room who you've never met, you've never seen them before in your life. Okay. When did the ignorance of that person begin? Yeah. We could say, the knowledge of my ignorance began the moment that person walked in the room, right? You can say, I've never seen that person before. Right? But the ignorance had no beginning. So what was your prior condition? When weren't you a durmati? You know, your durmati means seeing this anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition that is absolutely natural to ajnanam, to ignorance, is beginningless. And that condition is not going to be taken care of until your buddhi gains knowledge, right? So that's why he says this. He says, you know, even this being so, these five factors being there, you know, that are responsible for any type of karma, even that being so, the one who sees the non-dual Atma, self, as a karta, as a doer, the one who sees that, because he has not yet gained knowledge, akrita buddhi, because he's not yet gained knowledge, he says, that person he doesn't see, that durmati, that person who's a durmati, he doesn't see. Right? The one who sees the Atma as a karta, he doesn't see. The reason he sees the Atma as a karta, as a doer, is because he doesn't have knowledge yet. He's an ajnani. Ajnani is beginningless. He hasn't gotten knowledge yet. His buddhi is not formed yet. His knowledge hasn't taken place yet. And so, because of that, that person, that durmati, doesn't see the truth of how things are. Right? Okay, so, on the other hand, let's do this verse 17. Yasya na hankrito bhavaha, yasya na hankrito bhavaha, buddhira yasya na lipyate, buddhira yasya na lipyate, hatva pisa iman lokan, hatva pisa iman lokan, nahanti nani bhajyate, nahanti nani bhajyate, yasya na ahankritaha, bhavaha buddhihi yasya nalipyate hatva api sa iman lokan nahanti nanibhajyate. Here it says, on the other hand, for whom that person for whom there is no ahankara, that state of ahankara is not there, and whose buddhi therefore is not affected by karmapala, by the karmapalas. So here, first of all, for that person for whom that ahankara, state of having an I notion, the I notion isn't there. Remember, when we say ahankara, ahankrita means that state, that bhava, that notion of an I, the notion of an I, the bhava, the notion of ahankritaha, which of a created I, an I which has been made, so the I notion. So the notion in the form of an I, aham, right? It's called the ahankara. So the one for whom that ahankara is not there. What does that mean? It means that the aham, the atman, is yourself, is not subject to the ignorance. It has knowledge. It has not. The mind has knowledge. And so that aham, the conscious being, is not that you are, is no longer superimposed onto these five factors. It's not superimposed onto the buddhi, or to the I notion, the buddhi, the mind, the intellect, or to the manas, or to the physical body, or to the sense organs, or to the organs of action. The superimposition is not there, nor is it superimposed onto Ishwara either. It's not superimposed. Aham is aham. Aham is satchitatma. The conscious being that I am is where the aham lands. For an ajnani, the aham, the me, the I, who I am, is superimposed on this body. It's called anyonya adhyasa, the super mutual superimposition that's brought about only by self-ignorance. If self-ignorance isn't there, I'm not going to create this problem. Right? If to me the body is... If the self is known as I am, then the satya mitya of this body, mind, sense, organs, of all of these factors is something that's aparoksha. It's aparoksha means it's self-evident to me. This body enjoys me, but I'm completely free of it. The thoughts enjoy me, I'm completely free of them. The thoughts are me, it's like the pot is the clay is free of the pot. This body is me, and I am free of it. My emotions are me, I am free of my emotions. My karmendriyas, organs of action, are me, I am free of my karmendriyas, my organs of action. My sense organs are me, I am free of them. Are me, what do I mean are me? There's no other me, there's no other consciousness or conscious being that the sense organs enjoy. My body enjoys consciousness, it is me. The consciousness that the body enjoys is me. There's not another me, there's not another consciousness. But this me that the body enjoys is Brahman, is totally free of the body. That's the satya mitya relationship. Right? And so the one who knows this, even while having a body, seeing with my eyes, hearing with my ears, thinking with my mind, right, blinking my eyes, all of these things, doing all of these things, I'm not doing anything. Now what that means is at this moment, right now, you can notice that for I'm talking, you are listening. Okay. But while your listening is taking place because you have ears. Right? Cognition is taking place because you have a mind. Right? All of these things are known because of the Atma. True. That's all, but the knownness of the cognitions are only in the knownness of the cognitions are only in relationship to the cognitions. The knownness, you know, the utilization of your ears, that your ears enjoy consciousness so that they can hear. All of that language is only in relationship to the ears. The consciousness that they're enjoying is me, but I'm talking about it only in relationship to the upadi, to the conditioning adjunct. But all that while I'm talking about all of this in relationship to my body, mind, sense organs, there's simple me right here, right now, who's not doing anything. So see if you can just notice your own simple, changeless presence right now, that you're not doing anything at all. Nor are you ever, nor can you, nor do you want to. The being that you are is so, you, this me, this very personal me, doesn't want or have any kind of sankalpa or vrittis at all anyway. For it to want to be different, there's no vrittis, no thought modifications to make it want to be different. But it is whole and complete as you are. It would be, what if this me was a sad sack? Then that would be a bad thing because you can't do anything about it. The essence of your being is sad sack. Well, maybe since it's your essence, that would be fine. Right, but that your being, the being that the me that you are, is can't really be improved upon. You can't conceive. It's not possible to conceptualize an improvement. And It's kind of like, it would be very difficult to conceptualize six elements. You can conceptualize five, because there are five. But to conceptualize a sixth element is a real task. Try to make it up. And then try to make up a sense organ that goes along with it. It's not an easy thing to do. I can't do it. Maybe somebody can do it. I'm saying it can't be done. But it's not an easy thing to do. You know. And like that, to conceptualize yourself or to be in any way different than what you are is not possible. You know, like to imagine yourself as a sad sack, your being doesn't lend itself to being different than what it is. I don't know if this is making sense. It makes sense to me. So here what they're saying that is this, the one that doesn't have that ahankara means there's not this misidentification because that ignorance is gone. You can't really get it back. Then that buddhi nalipyate means that buddhi is not affected. It's not stained. What by any karmapala means your mind itself, your mind itself doesn't take on the karmas because there's no ahankara there. There's no I notion there. The buddhi, the ahankara, lands on the atma. That's the idea. Take the buddhi as the I thought or the knowledge thought of yourself. When I think of myself, it lands on me. I never change. And so I'm not subject to karma. For me, there is no karma. Because my being is not an object in the creation to be subject to karma, to doing or to thinking or to seeing or to any of these karmendriyas or any of these five factors that are responsible for doing activity. There's no possibility of my being able to do any of those things because my being is kevalam, it's one, it's pure, it's non-dual. So for me, I'm never changed or affected by any karma at all. Nothing changes the nature of the atma. So then he says, he has an example of it, he says, even having killed, because this is Arjuna's terrible dilemma, he's in the middle of the battlefield and he's so distraught about having to kill, you know, his teachers and his relatives and people that are very dear to him. How could I possibly do that? So what Krishna is saying here, and he said this in several verses throughout the Gita, that person, that atma, even having killed all of these people, even having killed Iman Lokan, all of these people, he probably has his hand pointing to the whole, you know, the whole two rows of thousands and thousands of people lined up for this war. Even having killed all of these people, Nahanti, he doesn't kill. Because Arjuna is going to be killing thousands of people. So he says, even though having killed all of these people, because these five factors are killing all of these people are going to be killed, right? Their bodies, their five factors are going to be killed. This body is going to kill those bodies. But the Atma isn't going to be doing anything. So even killing, I don't kill. Often what we call this is this, it's called mala nyaya, where pratama mala nyaya, where you knock off the strongest, the most egregious example. You knock that one off and then all of the others fall easily underneath. So I could say, I could be very benign and say, even walking across the room, I don't walk across the room. Well, this one has more punch. Yeah. Even having killed all of these people, I haven't killed anyone. Because the Atma is free of any type of action. And being free of any type of action, it's free from all action, it's free from all karma. There is no karma for the Atma. There's no actor, there's no karta, there's no karma. Karta and karma all depend upon this duality, and the karta, karma, all of this depends upon these, first of all, these five factors. And so he also says, so that person, you know, he doesn't kill, and also na nibadyate, Also, the Atma's not bound. There's no, the Atma doesn't need to be liberated. The Atma has never been bound and never will be bound. So you have no problem in reality. Your being is absolutely free. These problems all result from ajnanam, even the thinking that you yourself are bound and have to be liberated. You don't have to be liberated. Yourself is liberated. It's completely free. And it would have to be completely free, or it can never be completely free. If it's not completely free, as it is, it's existing within duality. And if it's existing within duality, it's not free. You're going to have to make up your definition of freedom. That which is ever dying. That which is ever changing. There is nothing really here. You have to say something like that. But here, from the Vedanta, what we say is the self that you are is infinite. It's changeless. It's kevalam. It's one without a second. There is no birth or death. There's no karma. There's no karta. There's no karma. The very being that you are is the being that you are. It doesn't have a past. It doesn't have a future. It doesn't have a present in terms of past and future. It is the presence of the present. In fact, in reality, you're never outside of the present. Anything is either a memory in the present or a projection in the present. You're never outside of the present. The jiva srishti takes you outside of the present. The jiva srishti, the machinations of your mind, the creations of you as a jiva. That's why in the meditation series that we're working on now, this present is Ishwara. When your mind is running amok, what I mean by that is when you're out in this imaginal la-la land that is full of emotion, it's a created reality, and you're living in that created reality, usually a catastrophic one. They usually tend to be catastrophic, not happy ones. If they're a happy one, you can just in a leap enjoy your nice imagination. You know, we don't even think about it. Oh, it's happy. Usually our projections in the future are filled with worry. That's jiva srishti. Or our, what we think about in the past, our worries, and if this would have gone this way or that would have gone this way, if this person had not done that, this person ruined my life, made a mess out of my life. You can spend so much time in this imaginal world that we call jiva srishti. So the sadhana, until it's natural, is when the mind is running amok in that way. If it's just daydreaming and having a nice time, there's no problem. You can just let it relax. It's not causing any damage. But when it is causing damage, on just not even a split second, you can bring it back. You know when we say vaktapas? Vaktapas is what you say in the world. It should be true. It should be beneficial, helpful. Hitam. Satyam, hitam, priyam. It should be kind. You can do the same with the manas. Manasatapas. Is this thinking true, or I'm just making this whole thing up? Is it useful? Is it helpful? Is it beneficial? Is it kind? Yeah. It should be those three things. If it's not, then I should make a decision whether I want to go on with that. Mm. With that. Or if it's just taking me on a ride. You know. I can make a decision. But I've never thought about it like that. You have to think about it like that. So that you can be aware when your mind is spinning out. That it's spinning out because the mind can spin out if you don't manage it properly. But you can manage it and pull it back to Ishwara Srishti. And then when you're in Ishwara Srishti, what is your duty in Ishwara Srishti? This is your prarabdha karma. This is the reality. This is what's happening now in terms of Ishwara. So then I just do here. What is asked of me to do here? How do I participate here? What is my dharma in this situation? That's it. That's Swamiji's famous story. I do what is to be done here every moment to the best of my ability. And that's all. Nothing else. That's what he said. I mean, I think that is the whole sadhana can be unfolded in that.
Mm-hmm.
The whole karma yoga, what is natural to a jnani, what is an effort for the karma yogi, the mumukshu who hasn't just become Ishwara, is what is natural to a jnani. For jnani, this from the atma out is Ishwara. So then what is the mind of that jnani? I just am here, I do what is to be done, what is called upon me to do, to the best of my ability, that's it. What does the karma yogi do? Well, I do what is to be done here to the best of my ability, but that kartritvam is still there. That doership is still there. There's not the maturity yet or the nishta in knowledge to just be Ishwara. To know that this all of this from subject and object both are equal. If the whole thing is only Ishwara. The self is Ishwara, the world is Ishwara. And so that's who I am. So the Jiva Srishti is not very active. And it is, if there is any activity in the Jiva Srishti, if it's problematic, then just bring it back, because you're not searching the world for ananda or trying to create it, because that is the very essence of your being.
Mm.
It's the essence of all beings, but when there's ignorance there, we're waiting for the mind to enjoy a condition where it experiences it, because all we know is the experiences that are given to us in our mind, because there's no viveka between the vrittis and myself. Right? There's no viveka this way. There's viveka this thought, this thought, this thought, this thought. But there's no viveka, no discrimination to recognize me as being the constant in all of those thoughts. And then to recognize my very nature as the ananda, which I've been seeking my whole life for. Chasing vrittis, trying to create vrittis, little glimmerings of ananda. And then finally getting the mumukshutvam, said these little glimmerings don't last very long. It's not good enough. This can't be the truth. Because I know intuitively there's something else. So, all right. Om Tat Sat. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmane Bhyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshati Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitah Brahmanasantu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschid Dukha Bhag Bhaved Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om.
If the atman doesn't require any liberation because it's already free,
yep.
Why does Vedanta spend so much time with that word, using it, moksha, liberation, mumuksha?
Well, because the Vedanta itself is for the mumuksha. Right? The Vedanta, the Upanishads, all of those things also exist within duality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just like the one who has the problem exists within duality. But the only thing is that the Upanishads point to, through Lakshana, that which is free, the very self of the duality. But it itself is as mitya as the jiva.
Mm. So
we'll say, in truth, there's no bondage, there's no liberation, there's no guru. There's in the Mandukya Upanishad, there's these verses that say this. There's no, in reality, there's no bondage, there's no liberation. There's no guru, there's no teacher, there's no sishya, there's no student. There's no dvaita. Right? This is all mithya. But it's the ones who are mithya that have the problem. Brahman doesn't have a problem. Your being doesn't have a problem. It's just the agnanam, the mind, you know, that has beginningless agnanam, ignorance, has a problem. And there's a solution for the one who has a problem.
So the liberation is really for the mind itself, not...
It's not for Brahman. It's for the jiva. Yeah.
That's very free.
Well, it has to be that way, or there isn't anything that we would call liberation.
It's almost like waking up from a bad dream.
Well, they do use that analogy. They use it in the Mandukya, you know, the second chapter.
And the jiva doesn't really exist.
Not really. Not in reality.
It's
mitya.
It's a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Ajnanam is mitya. The jiva is mitya.
Mm-hmm.
It's all mitya.
Mm-hmm.
So it exists within the confines of the mitya.
Right.
But mitya itself has no independent being apart from Brahman.
Mitya is mistaken perception.
Mitya is an order of reality that means that, like all the whole Maya, everything that exists within duality has the order of reality that we call mitya, which means Maya, if we do the kind of Vedantic etymology of Maya, is ya ma iti Maya, that which is not, that is Maya. What they mean by that is, here this Maya that we're experiencing, it has no being, but you can't say it's non-existent. That would be tucham, to say it's tucham. We can't say that because here we are experiencing it. Here I am. I can't say I'm non-existent. By non-existence, we mean something that's tucham. You can't experience it. You can't think about it because it's totally not there. It does not exist. So here when we say, we have to say mitya, we can't say this doesn't exist because it doesn't fulfill that definition of absolute non-existence, which is non-experienceable. And yet, this doesn't really exist, but here it is, so we call it mitya. We can't say that we have no experience of it, but we can't say it's real, that it's the truth either, because it has no independent being of its own. You know, so we say, mitya as an order of reality can't be categorized as satyam, that which is, which can never be negated. Or that which has no existence can never be experienced in any way. It's neither one of those things. So it's in between. The definition is sad asad bhyam, anirvachaniya. It means it can't be defined or categorized as satyam or as asat, non-existence. These two poles? No, neither one. So then you have to, well, what is mithya then? Well, besides what it's not. Well, it says that that which is dependent for its being on an adhishtana. The adhishtana is the thing that is actually there. Like, for instance, for clay pot, clay is what is there. Rope snake, rope is what is there. See what I mean? There is no independent thing that is there without that adhishtana. If I took away the rope, there would be no snake. If I took away the clay, there would be no pot. So it has a totally 100% dependency on something else where it's being. It has no being of its own. Mm. That's mithya. Mm. So the mithya jiva, and Ishvara is mithya.
Mm.
Right? Because all Ishvara is really is Brahman. But this maya is the, what Swamiji calls incidental attribute of Brahman. It means it belongs to Brahman, but it in no way affects Brahman. Because it has no being of its own. But what's so beautiful is if you think of just non-dual Brahman, conscious being, this infinite creation is like it's how it manifests itself without itself becoming. And so this is its display, its fireworks. It's an infinite manifestation that is not different from itself. Nor does itself, Brahman, go through any type of modification to become this. It's like the foam or something.
Well, it's almost like an imagination, Ishvara.
Maya is, on a total, would be like an infinite imaginative capacity.
And we have a finite one, so therefore, like, an infinite imagination can also actualize the gross objects, whereas our finite imagination doesn't have the capacity to do that.
Yeah, but you're looking at it not quite right there.
Okay.
Because there really is no gross, that there is really nothing gross. We only use that word in reference to the relationship between the sense organs, that we have sense organs, and what the sense organs perceive. Or what we call gross, as though there's something gross.
Well, I meant...
But wait, it's only gross, that terminology is only gross in reference to something more subtle that we call the mind and the sense organs. But we think of that gross as real matter.
Material.
Material. And then the mind as subtle.
Yeah.
But there is no real material that is gross compared to the subtle mind. Now, so to make that, to take that to the extension I want you to see,
mm-hmm.
is that when you have an imagination, say you have a daydream, or you do an active imagination, if you know how to do that, you're totally involved in this imaginal world, walking through the imaginal world, and you're thinking and seeing and talking. This division of subtle and gross is taking place within your imaginal world. Because you have sense organs in your imaginal world, and you have a mind in your imaginal world, you're thinking in your imaginal world, you're feeling in your imaginal world. So there's sukshma and stula, but the whole thing really is maya. It's not, there's not some matter, some physical matter, as though there's something real.
Yeah, that's right.
And if it's the same, I mean, the dream analogy is very good for really understanding that what we call matter is only in reference to the subtle experience, but actually it's not like there's anything that's matter. There's only consciousness, really. Because that tends to be problematic, because we think, yeah, but there's matter. You know, there's matter, there's consciousness, which is subtle, and then there's matter. They should be different. Well, there is no matter. There's mithya. There's maya, which is only mithya, which is nothing but consciousness. There's no matter. So we'd say that the consciousness is the clay of the pot, right? The consciousness is the matter. What we call matter is only consciousness. There's no matter.
I see.
Therefore, Ishvara does not exist.
What does that mean?
Because
there's no separate Ishvara from Brahman. Ishvara is Brahman. You can't bring in non-exist. Because non-exist means tucha, means
right, 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 right. You said that Ishvara is mitya, right?
Yes. Only because, now, you have to watch out. Like if I say Ishvara is mitya, that's not derogatory. Because you have to, a better way to say it, to go in this route, Ishvara is only Brahman. Brahman is Ishvara. But when we use the word Ishvara for Brahman, so this is relanguaging it a little bit, when we use the word Ishvara for Brahman, we're bringing in Maya. But with Maya, because Maya is mitya, there's really nothing there but Brahman. Because Maya is mitya, right? Mitya means that there is only 100% dependent for every part of its being on the Adhishtana, which is Brahman. So Ishvara is only Brahman, right? But when we say Ishvara, we're acknowledging the Maya Upadi. That's what that is. So it's not that Ishvara doesn't exist. It's that it's mitya, meaning the only thing that Ishvara, the truth of Ishvara, is Brahman. But the Ishvara Srishti is an empirical shared reality as opposed to the Jiva Srishti. So when you get to the Jiva Srishti, you're getting into a different subjective order of reality, where the Ishvara Srishti, from the standpoint of the Jiva, right, standpoint of the Jiva is important here, because that's why we make this distinction between Jiva Srishti and Ishvara Srishti. We only make that to help the Jiva out. Really, there's nothing here but Ishvara. And really, there's nothing here but Brahman. Right? But from the standpoint of the Jiva Srishti, we say Ishvara Srishti. And that's very helpful for the Jiva who is suffering, you know, who needs moksha, who needs to get liberation, needs how to handle the mind, to gain antakarana shuddhi, to solve the problem of suffering, which itself is mitya. But we're all in mitya. All the ones that are suffering are mitya. But we're suffering mitya.
Yeah, that's so
even though all of this is mitya, we would like it to not suffer.
Yeah.
I would like to not suffer, even if I'm mitya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want my mitya mind to have mitya suffering.
We want happy mitya.
Yeah, have happy mitya.
Yeah.
But to all the while, we can joke like this, but all of the while, you need to recognize the satyam. Which is, it's really the clay of the pot, the satyam. There is no distance between satyam and mitya. There's no distance between the clay and the pot, none. In fact, there's only satyam here, really. But it has to be recognized and has to be differentiated. You know, and in the Katha Upanishad, that you have one verse, they say, you know, it's like walking on a razor's edge to make this differentiation. They use the Hamsa bird. Analogy of the Hamsa bird is the famous mythical bird that goes into this bird bath filled with a mixture of milk and water, and it just sits on the perch and pulls out all of the milk and flies off. How to separate milk and water? How to do that? How to separate here satyam and mitya? Because there's no distance. There's no place where the mitya is that the satyam is not.
But it's easier than separating the milk from the water, right? I mean,
it is easier.
Yeah. Okay.
We would have to get some special equipment.
So I'm going to try this. It fair to say that Brahman is the self of Ishvara.
Okay. Well, the language has a little problem, but let's start with that. Because when you say self of Ishvara, you want to make sure that the of Ishvara, if you understand the mityatva, because there's a little duality when you say the self of Ishvara. Like if I say the self of my body, that's useful for a while, but in the end you have to realize the advaita, the non-duality and the satya-mitya relationship. So that's the language you have to be careful of.
Okay.
So it's useful up to a point.
Okay. And then Atma is the self of what? Is it Jiva or the body, mind, sense organs? Or both?
We'd say Atma is the self of the Jiva, because when we're saying that, what we're saying is that the Jiva is really a product of Ajnanam, ignorance, which brings about this Ahankara that causes a misidentification with the body, mind, sense organs. And so that Jiva has a self. From the standpoint of Ajnanam, the Jiva takes itself, the self that it is, that it has, and the Jiva has a self, it takes the self that it has to be the body, mind, sense organs, instead of recognizing itself to be Brahman. Right? And so, if I want to say the self of the Jiva is the self of Ishwara, the Jiva has the Ajnanam. It's the body, mind, sense organs that is suffering from the Ajnanam.
Okay, does the body, mind, sense organs have a self in the same way?
The self of the body, mind, sense organs is Brahman. But the problem is that the mind, body, mind, the mind includes the buddhi, is covered by Ajnanam. And so even though the self of the body, mind, sense organs is Brahman, because the mind has self-ignorance, the mind doesn't recognize the fact that that itself is Brahman, and that would mean, of course, that the body, mind, sense organs belongs to the whole, to Ishwara.
Could you say that for an Ajnani, the Atma is the self of the Jiva, but for a Jnani, the Atma is the self of the body, mind, sense organs?
We don't usually talk about it like that. We say, you could say that, but then you would have to do an unfoldment to make clear what you mean there. So we would usually say that the self of the Jiva is the Atma, but the Jiva is suffering from self-ignorance. If the self-ignorance that it's suffering from is the recognition that its very being, its very I, is Brahman. That's what it's suffering from. And so once that Ajnanam is removed, then what happens is that this body, mind, sense organs then is given over to Ishwara. And practically speaking, given over, because Ishwara, the Ishwara Upadhi is infinite, right? You give it over to the Prarabdha Karma, which is Ishwara. This is your little piece of Ishwara that this Jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, is here to experience.
I'm wondering if you could explain, what does it mean, given over to Ishwara? Because it doesn't mean...
not given over in any physical way, it's the recognition of the fact of it.
That it's a part of Ishwara. And yet, still, the buddhi and the mind, the manas, are still inhabiting the body, mind, sense organs. They don't somehow
become
Ishwara.
Oh, no, they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're limited. They belong to the subtle body. But once that Ajnanam is gone, when this body, which is all body, mind, sense organs, which is now part of Ishwara Srishti, Ishwara's creation, when this body dies, then there's no Jiva to continue on. Because already there's no Jiva. You know, in terms of Ajnanam. So there's only Ishwara.
So, in a way, the Jiva dies with the body?
The Jiva is already dead in a sense. It's only there in the form that it is there because of having taken birth of this body, mind, sense organs. But the Ajnanam is gone in terms of your self-identity.
The Jiva is the snake.
The Jiva is the snake. But the snake is because of the when you gain knowledge, the snake doesn't go away right away. Because when that example, rope snake example, is an example of pratibhasika, subjective projection. And so in a subjective projection, when you gain knowledge of the vastu, the thing that is actually there, the projection goes away. Even in psychology, right? It's like that. As you gain knowledge of the source of the emotion or whatever it is, the projection goes away. But this world and this body are an Ishwar Srishti. And so the subjective removal of subjective ignorance is not going to remove the objective Ishwar Srishti body, mind, sense organs. But when this body dies, there's nothing, there's no ajnanam left for the jiva to continue on as a jiva. Because practically speaking, the jiva is not here now except in the Ishwar Srishti form of what is left. Your body, mind, sense organs are left here in empirical reality without the ajnanam. And so the ahankara, for ajnani, the ahankara, it's not really, it's a mithya ahankara, the sense of self goes to the atma. If I think of who I am, it's not going to land on the body, it's going to land on Brahman.
But there's no change in his quality of sense of self. The sense of self he had...
before is the sense of self you have now, because you were always, that's the 50% correct.
that part.
You were right, and that yourself is yourself. What you didn't know is that self which you are is Brahman.
So that sense doesn't expand or doesn't increase?
No, it doesn't expand or increase from its own beingness. But in terms of, from the standpoint of the mind, it's coming to the forefront in terms of its presence, from the standpoint of the mind, increases because the mind is taking note.
Oh, I see. So there's a change there.
There is a change there because you've always been there as the self of every thought you've ever had and every emotion you've ever had. But you've always totally identified with the thought, totally identified with the emotion. That's the mind doing that. Now the mind has viveka. So not only does it recognize its own emotion, it's differentiated it from the constant, which has always been there. It's not, never been not experienced. It's always been there.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been differentiated.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a viveka going this way. This way. There's the viveka going this way. This thought is different from this thought. This emotion is different from this emotion is different from this emotion. But there's been no viveka between the substratum or the adhishtana, the me, that is there as the self of every single thought, every emotion, every perception, every experience. That viveka has not been there. And when that's there, then it's that comes to the forefront because the mind's awake to it. It's differentiated. It's mithya. It's mithya from the satyam.
So we should look to notice that.
So that becomes just the natural.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes natural.
Mm-hmm.
And until it's natural, then you keep noticing.
Okay. Thank you.
And when you gain self-knowledge, mm-hmm. and then you die, you realize that all is left is Brahman,
Ishwara. What is left is Ishwara. For Brahman, which is Ishwara.
The body is Ishwara, right?
But the body's dead, so the body's ashes.
Right, and the self-knowledge that is left is Brahman and Ishwara. Let's put it like this.
There's no self. The self-knowledge now has the knowledge. This is that Polavyapti and Vrittivyapti. For self-knowledge is different than getting knowledge of an object. When you're getting knowledge of an object, then there's something other than you. Right? Like knowledge of that painting. Then you have to recall it by bringing it back. Like say I walk out of the room, I'm not seeing the painting anymore, so now I have to have a memory of it, right? But with self-knowledge, that's different because I'm already completely here and I can't get rid of myself. And so the self-knowledge is not the gaining of a vritti for a new experience, right? It's a differentiation of viveka between myself as the constant that has always been here, where my mind recognizes that and turns toward the self that has always been there, and now the one that would normally illumine the self is the subject, right? So now that vritti goes away that got rid of that ignorance, but you're left. Right? Yourself is left. There's nobody going, yourself's not going to go away.
Right.
So it has nothing any longer to do with memory or carrying knowledge. That's why knowledge rests so, so lightly, because you're already here. You don't have to remember yourself. Like, say, I gain knowledge of the painting. And now, you know, I go on a trip and I think, what did that painting look like? I'm trying to recall it, my knowledge, my experience of it. Because it's not here. So that's different. That requires two, the palavyapi and vrittivyapi. Here, the ajnanam is removed, and I am here as the subject that will never go anywhere. The ajnanam is gone.
So there's the no vritti, recalling that.
The vritti does its job and it's gone. Right? Like here, the vritti does its job and then it's gone. If I leave the room, I'm not looking at it anymore, but then I have to do a function to bring it back. It's in memory. But here there's nothing, there's no function. Because I'm here. There's no memory required. The ajnanam has been removed.
And when the body dies, all that is left is Ishvara.
Yeah, the self with the mind. And see why I say that all that is left is Ishvara, is because Maya belongs to Brahman.
Right, right.
You are Brahman.
You cannot take Maya away from Brahman.
No.
So the reason why, let's say I gain self-knowledge.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm in this room,
yeah,
is because I'm experiencing Brahman from this location. When the body dies and I experience Ishvara, and I mean there is Ishvara, there is non-location. I can experience all locations, all.
That's not quite right. Let me do it a little differently, and then you can see.
Okay.
Brahman is its own self-experience. It's not. It doesn't require the universe or duality for its experience to be. It is self-evident consciousness. So it doesn't require anything for its experience. It simply is. Right? And so it's not like you are experiencing Brahman. Your body, mind, sense organs is not experiencing Brahman.
Right.
Brahman is the experience. It doesn't require duality for this me to be self-shining. So your mind isn't giving you the experience of Brahman from this location. The experience of Brahman is not an experience of, it's the self-evident conscious being that doesn't require any other pramana or any other means of knowledge to light it up. It simply is. Or I can say it personally, I simply am. If the whole universe goes away right now, I still am. It's like waking up from a dream. The dream becomes totally irrelevant. It could be the most intense dream, but when it's gone, nothing's happened, I still am. It doesn't contribute to my being or to my knownness as consciousness. Mm. And so there is no locale for Brahman. Brahman is non-dual, so there's nothing, it has nothing to do with location. There's nothing outside of Brahman. It's the center of everything. There's nothing away from it.
Yet I would experience myself, not myself, I would experience Maya, I would experience this room of Maya, right? I wouldn't experience...
Through your sense organs.
Through my sense, I wouldn't experience all the rooms of on Earth.
No, you wouldn't, because you are experienced, you have limited mind, limited by space and time, limited sense organs.
Right.
And so this, but the one who's experiencing the room is the mind and sense organs. Not Brahman. Even for Ishvara, with the infinite Maya Upadi, the whole infinite creation is like an infinite mind. Without that mind, there's no experience. There's no experience of the creation. The experience of the infinite creation as Ishvara requires Ishvara to be there, to be awake, for the creation to be manifest. Brahman is not experiencing Ishvara. Without the Maya Upadi, the Maya Upadi must be there for that experience to be there. And just like your mind must be dreaming in order for the dream to be known. If it's in deep sleep, there's no dream, there's no waking state. The experience of Maya needs the Maya to be there in some form of manifestation. Otherwise, the only thing there is me. with or without the creation. I'm not dependent on the creation to be or to have my own me experience, self-experience. The self-experience belongs to Atman, to Brahman. Not to anything. It has nothing to do with the creation. The creation is a non-contributor to Brahman.
That's a mind blower.
To the self-evident conscious being of Brahman, the self-experience of Brahman.
And why would Brahman, I don't know how to say it right, but why would Brahman experience this room if I gain self-knowledge and not?
Brahman's not experiencing the room.
Oh.
The only thing experiencing the room is the sense organs and mind that are in have Brahman for their being, but they're mitya.
Okay.
So Brahman's not a knower, Brahman's not experiencing the room. But from the stand
I see. I understand.
And not experiencing the creation either. But then that can think, oh, Brahman has no experience of the creation. No, it's not that. Satyam mitya means this mitya, which belongs only to Brahman, not to anybody else, but doesn't bring about any change, is its experience. But that experience doesn't bring about any change to Brahman. But the self of that experience is Brahman. The self of the experience of the creation is Brahman. The self of the jiva's experiences is Brahman. You know? But Brahman itself, from its own standpoint, is not going through any type of change or modification to become this experience. Does that make sense?
I'm getting there.
Yeah.
Getting
some there. Things have to click.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Like a little waterfall.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How is it that we as humans have this capacity to know Brahman and the table and the chair don't?
Oh. Within the creation, we would say that this table, the rug, all these various things, they don't have a subtle body. And so from their own standpoint, they don't reflect Brahman. It's the one example they use is if I hold up a mirror and a rock to the sun, one reflects it, one doesn't.
Hmm.
Right? But neither one of them,
yes,
both are mitya. But one has a sukshma sharira, you would say, if I stretch the example a little bit. One has a subtle body, the other doesn't. And so from the standpoint of Ishwara, all of this is known, but not from the standpoint of itself. So from the standpoint of Ishwara, the whole infinite creation is known because it's like an infinite vritti, like an infinite mind, as though. But within, think of it like this. If I ask you to have a meadow imagination, imagine a meadow and beautiful trees and all that, and you and your friends are walking through the meadow. And in the meadow there's rocks and benches and various things. So not everything in the meadow, imagination, enjoys consciousness. Only the living beings. And the living beings enjoy different degrees of consciousness, in a sense. Not really different degrees of consciousness, different abilities to have different capacities. That's a better way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
All the living beings have different sets of capacities. And they're not really better or worse. In fact, that's a speciesism that's caused so many problems in the world. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So we say that those which enjoy consciousness have some sort of a subtle body, whereas those that don't. Like we would say this table doesn't have a subtle body. If it does, we don't know about it.